listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2021, January 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Second Coming of Guru Jagat by Haley Phelan. In Harjuwan's own eulogy, he prophesied that Katie would return one day in the future as a little girl attending Rama University, Jagat's name for an educational center she had wanted to found. The second coming of Katie is how Norton put it, and Rama was cashing in. Everything she wanted is happening right now after she passes, the fame, the adoration, the sainthood. Over at Rama, regular classes had resumed almost immediately following Jagat's death. On August 8th, Rama promoted an event, Lion's Roar, in Jagat's honor. We are now in a cosmic window where hyperspeed, fulfillment, expansive courage, and unshakable strength are bioavailable. Whatever that means, it cost $88 to $99. Soon afterward, Rama began promoting tickets to Camp Grace, a women's camp devoted to deterritorializing the patriarchy that was inexplicably, or maybe explicably, led by Harjuwan. On August 30th, what would have been Jagat's 42nd birthday, Rama released a remix of a song, Truth, and a series of limited edition prints for $175 apiece. The photo, the same one that had hung behind the stage at the memorial, was similar to the one Rama had long sold of Bhajan, and, like Bhajan, it also appeared on altar cards meant to be stared at in devotion while meditating. The lyrics to Truth, a take on the John Lennon song, went tantalizingly, "All I want is the truth, just give me some truth." But what was the truth? Norton and Lowell, the team behind At Rama Wrong, told me they had received messages like, "I won't believe she's dead until I see proof." It was easy to understand why even her detractors couldn't believe she was really gone. Part of her genius, as much as it may also have been her madness, was an ability to make herself seem all-powerful. How had this teacher of the universe been felled by something as mundane as a broken ankle? Critics, as much as followers, wanted to believe in a more spectacular ending for Jagat. A few days after she died, Gurujas told a Kundalini class, according to someone who was present, that it is hard for people like Guru Jagat, who had so much energy, to stay on the earth this long. The suggestion, which began appearing on social media feeds of Rama followers, was that Jagat's death was merely another sign of her spiritual superiority. She hadn't died, she had ascended. According to the death certificate obtained by Vanity Fair, the facts of her death are as Rama claimed. There's nothing sensational or mysterious about it. Katie Ann Griggs, also known as Guru Jagat, died on August 1, 2021, of cardiac arrest, caused by a pulmonary embolism following surgery on her left ankle. During our conversation, Jagat had told me she was fascinated with the human mind, and I am fascinated with the way that people put meaning together, how to create meaning of their human lives. In today's information age, where everything can be attributed to metadata, or else maybe it was Mercury in retrograde, it's tempting to hold Jagat's death up as a sign of something, her karmic due. But her death was random, a fluke. In other words, it was human. Her mother said that when Katie first broke her ankle in Germany, she had called, worried. She said, "Mom, I'm scared." I told her to rest, just rest. but that was Katie. Guru Jagat was a different story. The decision to board a flight back to Los Angeles, back to Rama's headquarters, might have contributed to the embolism that killed her. But Guru Jagat had places to go, people to be. Rock star, Louis Vuitton's artistic director for high jewelry, Francesca Amfiteatrov, draws her inspiration from across time and space to create baubles that are out of this world. By Keziah Weir. Opening photograph by Sebastian Kim. Styled by Kia D. Goosby. And in the opening photo, the artist is present, Francesca Amfitheatrov, artistic director of Louis Vuitton's jewelry and watches at her home in Litchfield County, Connecticut. Here is an origin tale of which a brand can be proud. In 1832, a 10-year-old boy in Jura, an eastern region of France, loses his mother, a hat maker. His farmer father remarries a cruel woman, dies soon after, and the boy, now 13, leaves home to seek his fortune in Paris. Working odd jobs along the way, it takes him more than 2 years to walk the 292 miles. The boy's name is Louis Vuitton, and in 2 decades, he'll make trunks for the Empress of France. 200 years after his birth, his name will appear in rap lyrics and red carpet credits. It's like a Cinderella story, says Louis Vuitton's artistic director for jewelry and watches, Francesca Amfitheatrov. Reading your mind. Vuitton's youthful journey was her inspiration for this year's Haute Joaillerie, a staggering 90-piece collection dubbed Bravery in celebration of his bicentennial. I meet Amfitheatrov far from Vuitton's France at the Connecticut compound where she lives with her husband, Ben Carwin, a managing partner at an investment advisory firm, and her teenage children. The Litchfield County property, built in 1880, sprawls across nearly 15 acres and includes a small herd of white buildings, the main house, Amfitheatrov's studio, a guest house, 2 barns, plus a pristine pool and solarium, behind which grows a pear tree that would make Cézanne salivate. We settle at a patio table. Having just wrapped her Vanity Fair photo shoot, Amfitheatrov has changed into a loose silk dress that hits just above her knees. Her left ring finger glitters with 2 diamond bands, and on her opposite wrist she wears a black tag bracelet from the independent label she founded in 2019, Thief and Heist. The juggernaut that is Louis Vuitton has long served as a metonym of wealth in pop culture, though typically in reference to the brand's iconic leather goods. Audrey Hepburn, playing a jewel thief's widow in 1963's Charade, totes a set of Vuitton travel bags. Eddie Murphy's Prince Akeem in 1988's Coming to America has a fleet of them. Recently, the brand has amped up investment in its jewelry arm, and Amfitheatrov's hiring in 2018 was the starting gun. In early 2020, just months after Vuitton's parent company, LVMH, acquired Tiffany & Company for $16.2 billion, Vuitton made more waves in the gem world when it purchased the second largest rough diamond ever cut from the earth. The 1,758-carat Sewelo diamond, mined the year before, is so large that it could not plausibly fit inside a human mouth. If pop culture is any barometer, it's telling that the first episode of Netflix's label-loving reality show Bling Empire, which premiered in early 2021, centers not on a Vuitton bag, but jewelry. Called Necklace Gate 90210, the climactic scene involves one millionaire wearing a one-of-a-kind pink sapphire necklace from Vuitton's 2012 Haute Joaillerie collection to the home of another millionaire who supposedly owns the same piece. If one had to describe the designer in a single word, it might be considered. When making a point, she tends to hold her interlocutor's gaze while lowering her eyelids intensely, as though words do not quite suffice, but telepathy might. Between her statement eyebrows and high cheekbones, she resembles a face morph of Hepburn and Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra. Her voice is deep, and while she was born in Tokyo and spent her childhood in New York, Moscow, and Rome, a fittingly nomadic upbringing for a custodian of Vuitton's legacy, the British accent she picked up at a girls' boarding school in Kent and cemented at London's Royal College of Art, and subsequent decade-plus residing in that city, has stuck. She has served as the consulting creative director at Wedgwood, the head curator of Florence's Museo Gucci, and as Tiffany design director. Of her work-from-home wardrobe, "I can't say that I was wearing heels," she says, "but I wasn't in sweatpants." Amphitheatros designs for both the brand's fine jewelry collections, pieces like this year's popular bee blossom medallion, which run in the 4 to low 5-digit price range and are available to purchase online, and high jewelry, which sell for considerably more, to clients Amphitheatros often meets herself, have been vibrant and modern. She describes her technique as painting with gems. "I tend to use a lot of stones," she says, and shies away from the typical construction of a statement stone surrounded by smaller diamonds. "I think because I'm not a gemologist, I'm a bit more radical about it." Her design team was perplexed upon her arrival. "It's Place Vendôme," she explains, referring to Vuitton's Paris flagship, situated in the Ozymandian Square, constructed to honor Louis XIV. "It's very classic." Still, Amphitheatros' more is more habits are fitting for a brand whose own defining word would likely not be subdued. Le Myth, a multi-strand sapphire and emerald necklace featuring a central Vuitton fleur-de-lis, has 3 huge stones in it, Amphitheatros says. "Most people will make 3 necklaces, whereas I'm like, oh, all. Another called La Constellation d'Hercule, inspired by the stars visible at the time of Vuitton's birth, comprises more than 30 scarab beetle-sized tanzanites, savorites, and opals that look like an image downloaded from Hubble, plus 15 diamonds cut into Vuitton's patented flowers and stars. Next photos, circles of light. A sketch of the Bravery Collection Savoir-Faire's Le Star du Nord necklace. Le Star du Nord necklace in white gold, featuring 104 custom-cut diamonds. The collection also includes the Arrow necklace, the Arrow ring, and La Constellation d'Hercule necklace in white gold and platinum. "No other house has branded a diamond," declares Amphitheatros. She credits Vuitton CEO Michael Burke, who personally approves each stone purchase with the brand's team of crack gemologists. "On the state of mining," she says, "it has to be done more consciously. In Botswana, the gold standard for mining practices, the diamond trade has provided universal health care and free basic education. But across the industry, the actual job of excavation remains hazardous and environmentally impactful." Her own favorite piece from the collection is actually 2 glittering bracelets with fraternal twin center stones, a diamond and Colombian muso emerald dubbed Le Venture that can be worn together as a single cuff or split up, one on each wrist. "It's so well balanced," she says, "that you wouldn't change a thing. I go to our CEO and I say to him, 'I've got this idea,'" she says of her creative process, "and then I retreat." She builds a mood board and divides her greater organizing narrative, in the case of Bravery, teenage Louis' 2-year-plus trek, into themed chapters. "I can't just, oh, here, there's a beautiful star," she ad-libs mock theatrically. "Let's repeat the star everywhere, and that's going to be my inspiration. I just get bored." Narrative is now a retail buzzword, but for Amphitheatros, it's just how her brain works. Her father was the Russia bureau chief at Time magazine. Her mother did PR for Valentino and Armani. Her paternal grandfather was the composer and conductor responsible for scoring Lassie Come Home, and his father was a Russian novelist who once dressed down H.G. Wells. As she describes it, "I've always been surrounded by a certain depth to things. The bookshelves in her cavernous studio are arranged by color and include celebrity memoirs, but also Proust and the Platonic Dialogues." Her record player spins Herbie Hancock and The Doors and Blue Note Live at the Roxy. She has always loved Mark Rothko. Günther Uecker is a more recent obsession. "I've got holiday brain. What's the name of the German artist," she says, smizing at me, "that paints with nails?" Last year was not an easy one for luxury business. LVMH revenue dipped from more than 53 billion euros in 2019 to around 44.7 billion in 2020, which is still more than double that year's GDP of, say, Botswana, where the Sewelo diamond was mined. But Amfitheatrof says high jewelry really was revalued during COVID. People found it difficult, especially people with a lot of wealth, to have satisfaction because your passions were stopped. Jewelry became something that is not only an amazing investment, but you can wear it and enjoy it, and husbands can see it on their wives. The world is full of shocking disparity, but the pandemic threw it into particularly sharp relief. Is this dichotomy, I ask, something that Amfitheatrof has grappled or contended with, or... No, she says. No. I mean, my thing is, we're not in a fast-moving industry category. I know what I make is going to last more than our lifetimes, so I have to think really in a timeless way. While rarity in fashion is almost always a constructed scarcity, a sneaker can be produced at a greater volume, but its maker chooses not to. In the world of high jewelry, supply can't be bolstered, only faked. Most of the Earth's mined gold is believed to have been deposited like beautiful space litter by a meteorite that collided with our planet in its relative infancy. Our diamonds are mysterious, forming 100 miles below the Earth's surface over hundreds of millions, even billions, of years. In this sense, time really is luxury, and to preserve value, a Vuitton gemstone must never have been treated with oil, except sometimes emeralds, or heat, which alters color, or have been grown in a lab, God forbid. As if sensing that our time together is ending, a succession of Amfitheatrof's dogs by order of size flounce from some unseen open door. A tiny black Pomeranian named Archie, followed by a crotchety Jack Russell called Bella, and finally the family guard dog, Quincy. They settle on the paving stones around the pool, content. There are dog years and human years, and both pale in comparison to the lives of gemstones. The American 13-year-old in 2021 is younger than the French 13-year-old was in 1835, and while Amfitheatrof's own teenagers won't be trekking solo to, say, Washington, D.C. anytime soon, after a surfeit of family time, she hopes they'll at least get to attend some parties. "He could have taken 2 weeks to get to Paris," Amfitheatrof says of Vuitton, whose own home region is now perhaps better known for the Large Hadron Collider, which straddles the Swiss border some 300 feet beneath the base of the Jura Mountains and allows scientists in search of our universal origin story to mimic the conditions that existed a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. He chose this time to become the man that he wanted to be, and I think that that's phenomenal. The End of Forever. Sebastian Junger covered the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan at its beginning. Now he weighs the cost of slowly losing our righteous war, with photographs by Tim Hetherington. Opening photo, an Afghan National Army soldier and civilians amid the rotor wash of a U.S. UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter landing in the village of Yaik Sheen, October 2007. And next photo, a soldier in low sunlight in the Karangal Valley during Operation Rock Avalanche, October 2007. Visions of War, British photojournalist Tim Hetherington's intuitive sense of the human condition, combined with his study of the impact of conflict, led to some of the most important visual documents of the war in Afghanistan. Our image of combat is a bunch of tough young guys in some fearsome-looking gear raining hell on the enemy, says journalist Sebastian Junger, who covered the war with Hetherington for Vanity Fair. In fact, there's a lot of other sides. Tim really saw the soldiers' vulnerability. The Taliban delegation to Jalalabad in the summer of 1996 was a dour bunch of old men who took their meals together at a long table in the dining room of the Spingar Hotel. They were there to negotiate the surrender of Jalalabad, and I was there to document the last stand of the Afghan government, such as it was. So there were some hard stares across the breakfast buffet. Then we would all go out and face the jet engine heat of the day. A week later, I was driving through Kabul when a Taliban gunner opened up on us with a machine gun. The Taliban already harbored Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda figures in Afghanistan, but the Islamic State was not yet in existence. My driver cranked a U-turn and roared back up the ruined boulevard. "We hate those people," he said, "but they promised to clean up corruption, and so we will let them into our country." The Taliban claimed Kabul weeks after I got out, hanging President Najibullah from a streetlight for corruption, and completing their 3-year campaign to establish an Islamic government in Afghanistan. From there, I was told by a captured Taliban fighter they plan to wage jihad across Southeast Asia and eventually the world. The one part of the country that never fell to the Taliban, however, was the rugged northeastern quadrant controlled by ethnic Tajiks, under the command of legendary guerrilla fighter Ahmad Shah Massoud. In the fall of 2000, 4 years into the Taliban reign, I made my way from Tajikistan into the free areas of Badakhshan province, where I spent 2 months alongside Massoud and his commanders. I watched Massoud play a brilliant and desperate chess game against the vastly superior Taliban forces, holding ground and even liberating new areas. Massoud warned me that Pakistan, supposedly a U.S. ally, was directly supporting the Taliban, and that al-Qaeda was planning a huge attack on the West in the coming year. Massoud repeated those warnings to the French Congress in Paris the following April, but no one took it seriously. On September 9, 2001, Massoud was assassinated by al-Qaeda suicide bombers, and 2 days later, hijacked airplanes flew into the Pentagon and the Twin Towers. A fourth plane was supposed to take out the Capitol building in Washington and effectively decapitate the U.S. government, but passengers bravely forced it down into a field in Pennsylvania. 1 month later, I was back in Afghanistan, and my country was at war. After weeks of strangely lackadaisical bombing by American planes, Massoud's Northern Alliance surged across the Somali plain toward Kabul. Tanks and pickup trucks and bicycles and men on foot converged on the two main roads leading into the city and streamed southward, fighting as they went. On November 13th, We walked into the city at dawn past a clutch of dead Taliban fighters who lay vacant and twisted in a pile by the side of the road, executed hours earlier. The people of Kabul were dancing in the streets and flying kites and carrying radios that blared Indian pop music. A young boy sailed by on a bike, playing a harmonica, and a man came up and hugged me when he found out I was American. I had always wanted to see a city liberated, and my wish had finally been fulfilled. Not only that, but it was my own country that had done the liberating. I felt a warm infusion of national pride. Many Americans are now fond of saying, knowingly, that the war was unwinnable because it's Afghanistan, graveyard of empires, a rugged land filled with proud people who are happy to fight to the death. But that kind of breezy dismissal just allows us to avoid the embarrassing conversation about what actually went wrong. America had overwhelming military superiority, the approval of more than 80% of Afghans polled in 2004, and the sympathy of the entire international community after the attacks of 9/11. The scale of those attacks also gave us the kind of legal, moral, and strategic justifications that were utterly lacking in Korea and Vietnam. Hetherington, who was killed in Libya in 2011, was more than a conflict photographer. His work across mediums, housed in the Imperial War Museum, challenged the conceits of photojournalism and our assumptions about war and young men in the developing world. Next photos, a grenade bandolier with handwritten annotations at the Restrepo outpost in the Karangal Valley, September 2007. And each grenade is inscribed with its intended avenging target or avenging for whom it is meant to avenge. 9/11, New York, for Mom, and other names, indicating just how personal these battles were. Junger and Hetherington worked primarily in the Karangal Valley, one of the most dangerous outposts in Afghanistan, where they lived with 2nd Platoon Battle Company, 173rd Airborne Brigade. Their film about the experience, Restrepo, won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary at Sundance in 2010 and was nominated for an Oscar. "We were just as close to the other soldiers as we were to one another," Junger says. "We were completely at home there." Next photo, civilians take cover from a dust cloud during a patrol in the Karangal Valley, October 2007. If there could be a sure thing in warfare, this was it, and we blew it. To be clear, American efforts in Afghanistan can't really be compared to the vast imperialist undertakings of the British and the Soviets. If anything, we weren't imperialist enough. Taliban resistance collapsed almost immediately in 2001, but instead of following through with a massive infusion of troops and relief, the Bush administration moved on to a completely unnecessary war in Iraq. Afghanistan was initially allotted only about 10,000 American troops, one quarter the size of the New York City police force, and was all but abandoned by the State Department. Iraq was the place to be for ambitious young Americans in the Bush administration. Afghanistan was a backwater. Afghans looked on in amazement. "You lost almost 3,000 civilians to Al-Qaeda, and this is all you got?" For Afghans debating whether to collaborate with American forces, this was not looking like a good bet. We know what happened to the Kurds after the first Gulf War, one Afghan told a friend of mine. President Bush abandoned them after the war, and they were massacred by Saddam Hussein. Now, another member of the Bush dynasty, George W., was offering a similar deal. Incredibly, many Afghans accepted. Even with that small level of support, the Afghan endeavor might have worked had the Bush administration and then the Obama administration tackled the one thing that Afghans have always demanded and that all people deserve, an honest and transparent government. Instead, we essentially stood up a huge criminal cartel that posed as a government. President Hamid Karzai's brother, for example, was the recipient of $23 million in loans from the National Bank that everyone knew he would never have to pay back. The son of the former Speaker of the Afghan Parliament, Rahman Rahmani, was given millions of dollars in contracts to supply fuel and security to U.S. military bases. And a food chain of corrupt officials continued to impose a vast and humiliating extortion system that squeezed money from ordinary Afghans every time they went through a checkpoint, filed paperwork, or even applied for a job. Military commanders even dunned money from their own soldiers' paychecks for the privilege of wearing the country's uniform. There was no reason for Afghan soldiers to fight and die for such an enterprise, and by 2005, the next time I was back in country, the Taliban had regained control of entire districts and were largely dictating the nature of the war. Our high-tech military could win every battle, but was useless against an enemy that moved with ease through a civilian population that feared and even hated them. The U.S. is effectively trying to weed a garden with a backhoe, I wrote in this magazine in 2006. The enemy is forced to wage war while avoiding actual combat, which becomes, for a conventional army at any rate, a much harder problem to solve. While I was there, I visited an old friend, Sarah Chayas, a former NPR reporter who has covered Afghanistan and the author of three nonfiction books, who had taken a taxi across the Pakistan border in late 2001 and soon installed herself as a one-woman reconstruction agency in downtown Kandahar. Sarah and I had grown up together outside Boston, and our lives had strangely converged in Afghanistan. Sarah had rented a house, acquired an old Taliban pickup truck, put an AK-47 under her cot for security, and started rebuilding houses that had been destroyed by American bombs. She says that she immediately ran into corruption. Governor Gul Aga Sherzai had given himself a monopoly on stone, of all things, and forced the U.S. military to buy crushed rock from him at an astronomical markup. When Sarah complained that she needed uncrushed rock to repair houses, Sherzai told her to rebuild with cement, which came from a factory that he owned as well. Sarah spent almost a decade in Kandahar, learning Pashto and embedding herself so deeply in Kandahari society that the U.S. military had the good sense to hire her as a civilian advisor. She wound up working for three top ISAF commanders, and finally inside the Pentagon, reporting directly to Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. According to Sarah, some field commanders knew how important anti-corruption measures could be because they had watched Taliban-controlled areas open up to them when corrupt local officials were deprived of unregulated development cash. Nevertheless, in 2011, the Obama administration ignored Mullen and other senior commanders and decided that U.S. policy would not challenge corrupt practices in Afghanistan. After that, it was game on for a cash mill that saw a total of $2 trillion spent by America in Afghanistan. civilian officials from agencies like USAID, the State Department, and Congress continued to launch obscenely inflated development projects that could turn Afghan governors into millionaires overnight. Military contractors continued to unwittingly pay Taliban commanders to refrain from attacking supply convoys, and Afghan officials brazenly stole the paychecks, ammunition, and even food of Afghan soldiers fighting on the front line. On paper, the U.S. paid for a 300,000-man Afghan army, but the actual number was much smaller, and the difference, of course, was pocketed by Afghan officials. American policies were so contradictory, in fact, that many ordinary Afghans concluded that the U.S. was secretly allied with the Taliban and just pretending to be at war. Because I had spent a lot of time with U.S. troops in the infamous Korangal Valley, Senator John Kerry invited me to meet with him in late 2010. Kerry was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and said that he wanted to hear my thoughts on how the war was going. We met in Kerry's office after he had gotten off an overnight flight and his eyes were heavy with sleep. "The war is not winnable unless we deal with corruption," I recall telling him, doing my best to channel Sarah's insights. His response was that the U.S. simply didn't have enough leverage to press the issue. "If we cut off the money," I remember him saying, "the government would simply revolt." "Then tell them we'll leave," I said. "If the Taliban take Kabul, every minister is dead, and they all know that." "There's a particular look that officials get when they know you are right, but their hands are tied," and Kerry had that look now. He thanked me for my insights, and I never heard from him again. When the Taliban finally seized control of Kabul in August, it was a swift and predictable advance that was remarkable mostly for its lack of violence. Afghan soldiers who had not been paid or resupplied in months often chose to surrender rather than fight, happy to have survived what had become toward the end something of a turkey shoot. As the Taliban drew close, President Ashraf Ghani fled the country by helicopter with a reported $169 million in cash. It was a fitting exit for an utterly corrupt leader that America had no business supporting. Ghani's exit revealed to the world what Afghans had known for years, that roughly 2,500 Americans and 70,000 Afghan soldiers were killed, protecting what was essentially a vast criminal racket. Another 50,000 civilians were killed as well, some in U.S. airstrikes, but many from car bombs, suicide bombs, and other insurgent attacks. Our failure does not mean that the Afghan war was unwinnable or entirely without merit. We decimated Al-Qaeda, killed Osama bin Laden, educated a generation of Afghan children, and helped bring the country into the modern era. And there are good outcomes that might not have been possible without U.S. involvement. The Taliban probably don't want to remain a pariah state under threat of another American invasion. So this time around, they may well refrain from harboring terrorist groups and carrying out some of their more horrific policies toward women and ethnic minorities. Was it worth the cost? History will tell. But it is abundantly clear that four successive American administrations, two Republican and two Democratic, utterly betrayed the public trust. The question isn't why a war-ravaged country failed to thrive under our tutelage. The question is why a great and powerful nation like the United States couldn't win a small, righteous war that would have benefited the entire world. If we answer that question, we have a chance at remaining the leader of the free world, as President Harry Truman put it after World War II. But I wouldn't count on it. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Mel Brooks, the EGOT, winner and author of All About Me on Limos, Birthmarks, and the Best Vacation Ever with Carl Reiner. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being in a Broadway theater full of people laughing their heads off at one of my shows. What is your greatest fear? A Broadway theater filled with nothing but critics. What do you dislike most about your appearance? Looking older than I really am. I'm only in my 90s. What is your most marked characteristic? A strawberry on my tush and a unique sense of humor. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Benjamin Franklin. He was smart, witty, and had a lot of hair in the back. Which living person do you most admire? Probably me, but I don't think I'm supposed to say that. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Being too damned self-absorbed. Which living person do you most despise? My proctologist. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Never picking up the check. What is your greatest extravagance? I think it's taking limos to the airport and always flying first class. When and where were you happiest? Probably during my childhood, growing up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Which talent would you most like to have? Bookkeeping. I know I'm being screwed, but I don't know how. What is your favorite journey? It happened every summer from about 1982 to around 1989. My best friend, Carl Reiner, bought a house in the south of France. My wife, Anne, and I, along with two other friends, would fly over to see Carl and his wife, Estelle. We'd eat, drink, play word games, and generally have a wonderful time. After 2 weeks, we would get up early in the morning and begin a drive to Venice. We would stop along the way to have breakfast in Genoa, then lunch in Bologna, and we'd arrive in Venice at sunset. Now that was a journey. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My family. What is your current state of mind? Mostly positive, with occasional bouts of anxiety. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Height. I'd make them all taller, especially me. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A giraffe. Have I mentioned I'd like to be taller? What do you most value in your friends? Taking daily showers and always being there when I need them. What do you consider your greatest achievement? The producers, both the original 1967 film and the 2001 Broadway musical. What is your greatest regret? Agreeing to fill out this questionnaire. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Mel Brooks. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.